That interview is coming right up. Our website, if you don't know, is thirdopinionpodcast.com. Give it a visit. You can leave us a comment or suggestion, learn more about our hosts, and hear podcasts you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions, on WKDW, as well as the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorraine Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are with us again today. Ukraine is topping all our news. We were talking before we started. It is just absolutely heartbreaking, and I'm glued to the TV. Aren't you, Lorraine?
It's really horrific. I mean, I think, you know, for instance, in Mariupol, that one town on the, you know, in the Black Sea, that you know, Russia's just been bombarding mercilessly, nonstop for 3+ weeks now. I mean, the fact that they were, you know, they intentionally struck a theater where, you know, something like almost close to 2,000 civilians, families, elderly, children were that remained, that weren't able to escape, were
and the Russians knew that there were children there.
Right. And as we speak, Mike, so far the rescue workers have been able to get out 300 survivors, but there's estimated at least another 1,300 people buried underneath that rubble. And, you know, obviously, as we're recording this, as the minutes pass, there's, you know, less likelihood of their survival. It's so horrific what Russia is doing, and these innocent people who are just living their lives. And I'm just, you know, at a loss for words sometimes. I don't, did you watch? I will tell you, you know, I was very moved and impressed by President Zelensky's speech when he addressed the U.S. Congress this week. I watched that.
It gave me goosebumps. It really did, particularly when he showed that film showing how Ukraine a month ago was, everybody was carrying on their lives as you and I are today, as if nothing was wrong. Because as we talked last week, it's a modern country. And then he showed the destruction. And then when he came back and spoke in English,
so powerful.
And then he's done the same thing, actually, with the Canadian Parliament and with the English Parliament and with the German Reichstag.
Yeah.
And he's been impressive each time. One of the toughest things that he said was the phrase "never again" is meaningless because it's happening.
Right. Exactly. I mean, look, Ukraine is beautiful, historic country, cities that are ancient, thousands of years old. And not only that, but it was also really one of the breadbaskets of the world. I mean, it is one of the largest wheat producers and exporters for Africa and Asia and Europe and Russia too. I mean, which is really going to start impacting, you know, this is the other concern. Obviously, can this cause famines in the world where people don't have access now to bread to eat? And, you know, the fact that he's very passionate, he knows, he understands the issues, but he's very right invoking the issue of never again, in particular with Germany and in Europe, just saying, look, you know, this just happened, you know, not even 100 years ago, the world stood silent and watched, you know, as millions of people were being slaughtered by Nazis. And now we've got Putin, who's using this fake lie of denazification, right? I mean, Stalin is like, I'm calling him Stalin. Yes. Putin, he's like,
well, he's Stalin, he's Hitler, he's Haman, all rolled up into one.
He sure is
a monster. He is just a murderous war criminal monster. There's no other way to put it.
I know. And just today, of course, he holds a big, you know, a big celebration for himself, a pro-war rally in his, in the Russian National Stadium to like, woohoo, I'm so great. You know, I'm waiting for someone close to him to take him out. Of course, he just started arresting a couple of his top generals, probably because he knows, like, they're looking at him going, you're crazy and we have to remove you. But, you know, I thought it was interesting. There was, you know, going back to the never again speech that he gave in Germany, that President Zelensky gave in Germany, you know, two things I thought were really interesting. There was an interview by Daniel Lipschultz. I think he was interviewed by Sky News, and I think he was also interviewed by CNN, but he was interviewed by Sky News.
Sky News, by the way, is doing a fabulous job.
They are covering everything.
Listen, you got to give the networks, the reporters, the photographers, the producers, tip of the hat, because they're in danger. They are in danger. They're all doing a great job. But Sky News has, I thought, been spectacular.
Their live updates are super helpful. I will tell you, obviously, talking about reporters, I mean, I think two of Fox News reporters were killed this week. I think one of the reporters that was there for Times Magazine was killed, which they were all shot and killed by Russian soldiers this week. They died through Russian shelling. You know, so you reporters are being, in essence, you know, targeted. And this is, that's also, again, just really frightening to think about it. But this man, Daniel Lipschultz, he's a religious Ukrainian Jew. And he's urging all Jews and all people to help fight against this evil Russian aggression. He's like, look, we saw this happen just 80 years ago, and people just stayed at home and watched on TV pretending to be ignorant. Like, he's like, we have to do something. We cannot be ignorant. We cannot be silent. There are millions of ways to help. You don't have to go to combat. You can help with, you know, humanitarian aid, whatever it is, but do something. Don't be silent. Like, we all have to speak up.
I think the line that he used in the article was, no one stood up to Hitler.
That's right. No one's exactly. And now, but we have to stand up to Putin. The world has to stand up to Putin. And I thought the other thing was really interesting is, you know, you're hearing, you know, some of these young Russian soldiers, they're just kids, right? They're conscripts. They're being told to go into to Ukraine to liberate the Ukrainian people from these Nazis. And they're being told this whole like fake storyline by Putin's evil governmental structure. And then they get there and they're getting, you know, some of these POWs are like, there's nothing about that. He's like, and they're talking about this. They're being interviewed. There are some of them that are being interviewed by CNN about what was happening. And they're like, they're personally horrified that, you know, because they're seeing that civilians are being targeted and that we're not liberating them from anything. And we're in essence targeting civilians and children. They're dying because of us as Russians. And they didn't see anything about Nazis or fascists.
Yeah, they said we didn't see any Nazi fighting. And they oppose. They don't understand why they're there.
All right, that's right. These young soldiers, they don't know. They're not being told what their targets are. They're just being told to drop bombs here and there. And they're being sold a bill of goods. Because, you know, look, Putin has shut down social media. He shut down any independent media. So all that you get in Russia now is state-run news. And you can't say anything contrary to Putin's, I'll tell you the other, you can't say anything contrary to Putin's storyline, right? But the other scary thing this week, if you watch Putin's speech to the Russian people, he was pretty much saying, we need to root out the traitors. Like, if your neighbors among you are not for this war, then they're not true Russians. And we pretty much need to rid Russia of this cancer. I mean, how Stalin was that? Stalin killed millions upon millions upon millions of Russians.
And it's Hitler-esque too. I mean, it's very Hitler-esque. That's what I thought of when I heard that as well. I mean, and obviously the threat, the problem is the nuclear capability. It puts us in a real conundrum as to what to do. I mean, because otherwise we'd go in and slap him down, I believe, or the Russian army, which has been proven to be not as effective as we thought they would be. They've been embarrassed here, but you've got that nuclear threat that is so scary.
I don't think he would do it. I don't think he's serious, but you know, bullies, the one thing that I, you know, about bullies is you've got to just punch him in the mouth. I mean, and it shuts him up. You know, he's going to say what he needs to say, because I think Putin, like him or not, he's very shrewd and he knows how to push certain buttons to be able to stop us from acting. And I don't think he actually is going to do it. I don't think he has the balls to do it. I think he just is saying that because he knows it's going to put us in fear and stop us. I mean,
the hope would be that the other Russian generals who might not be crazy like he is, I mean, he wants to be Peter the Great, apparently, as a picture of him in his office. He sees himself as Peter the Great, but hopefully some of the other Russian generals would say, wait a second, we don't want to do that. But on the other hand, Pat Robertson, of CNN, not CNN, I'm sorry, CBN, the Christian Broadcasting Network, said, well, it's okay, we can do the nukes because we've got more nukes than he does. And if worse comes to worse, it'll be the end of times, which will fulfill the prophecy of Jesus. Pat is an interesting guy. When I was in Norfolk, the CNN was in Virginia Beach, which was adjacent to Norfolk. It's like Brandon in Tampa, for those of you who live in the Tampa Bay area, but it's just a suburb of there. And Pat is he's got some strange ideas. I interviewed him live several times. He thought that gay people in San Francisco wore rings that infected straight people with AIDS during the AIDS epidemic. Yeah, Pat is, but I want to tell you something. He is one of the most effective manipulators of the camera I have ever seen. And at one point he was talking about running for president, and he scared the hell out of me. His father was a senator from Virginia, a U.S. senator. He was politically connected, and he could manipulate the TV like you would not believe. But and he said, yeah, it's okay if we have the end of times, which again, I mean, I'm getting off.
I just want to say, I don't think that he speaks for the majority of the Christian world. I don't heard anyone else say that. So I would
agree. But then it gets back to the old argument I've made, that part of the reason that the Christian community is so supportive of Israel is because it's in the prophecy of Jesus coming back. That's my little tangent.
Yeah, but I don't think that has anything to do with what Pat Robertson is saying. Pat Robertson is just like, that's just a crazy statement. But I do want to get back to Israel really quickly on this one thing, because I think it's important to talk about this. So, you know, we had the consulate general on with us last week, Mike. And this week there was some more reporting. It was in the Times of Israel about the field hospital. I think we had mentioned that Israel had already sent a lot of humanitarian aid. I think something like 10 tons of humanitarian aid into Ukraine. And now they have literally coordinated, and they have set up a field hospital within Ukraine. They're sending, shipping like 7 tons of medical equipment.
You've got $4 million is being funded.
Right. Yes. And you've got doctors and nurses and others from Israel going there to help this effort, you know, and one of the concerns, obviously, as the World Health Organization has noted multiple times, as of today, Russia has attacked 43 hospitals and health facilities in Ukraine, has bombed and directly attacked hospitals and health facilities in Ukraine. And so one of the things that Israel's been doing is going, you know, in part of this coordination is letting Russia know, like, hey, these are our planes, we're flying in, we're setting up a field hospital, because they don't want Russia to accidentally or intentionally bomb their field hospital, which clearly, you know, is a legitimate concern given what Russia's been doing.
What they've done, right. Meantime, Israel is starting to take in refugees from Ukraine, and the Palestinian Authority is slamming them for taking in refugees.
I know.
What's wrong with this picture? What is wrong with this picture? What's wrong with those people? These are people in dire need. I look at the little kids, and it really wants to make you cry, and it's so heartbreaking. And this is going on in our world. This is not ancient history. I mean, this is happening right now. It's hard to believe that this is happening right now.
Right, they're being so traumatized. They're being absolutely, these children are being absolutely 100% traumatized, and I it just really concerns me. It's horrifying.
It is horrifying.
These children, yes.
I do actually have a nice story coming out of Ukraine. It was on CNN, and I want to give them credit for this. It's about a woman whose grandmother was saved by a Ukrainian family during World War II. She was obviously Jewish. They hid her at the threat of being executed for hiding Jews. And now she is in Israel and has run across the grandchildren of the woman that saved her grandmother. And she's in the process of bringing them to Israel. Isn't that a wonderful story?
I love this.
Let's take a listen. This this is, you know, there's not many stories out of Ukraine that make you smile and say, well, there is still some goodness in the world. This is one of them.
During World War II, Maria Blitschik sheltered and saved the life of Fania Rosenfeld Bass, a Ukrainian Jew. And now Fania's granddaughter is returning the favor. She is helping to bring Maria's family from Ukraine to Israel. Joining me now is Sharon Bass. Sharon, this story is amazing. And I think about watching you. I see you. You are here because your grandmother survived, because of someone else's grandmother. The roles are really reversed here. Tell us about your grandmother's survival of World War II first.
Okay, so the story of my grandmother and my old family, you know, goes back 8 years ago to World War II, when my grandmother was the sole survivor of her family. And the rest of her family was slaughtered and put in mass graves by the Nazis. And she found herself for a whole year, you know, wandering the forest of Ukraine. Until 1 year later, this righteous family found her in the forest and gave her a home and a shelter and treated her like their own daughter. And by doing that, you know, they risked their all life, the whole lives of the whole family. And, you know, I'm indebted to them forever. I feel, like you said, that the reason I'm here alive and I have a family, three sons, and, you know, is because of them. So it was my moral obligation to assist them and to get them out of the war zone.
And so Maria, who is the woman who saved your grandmother, this is her granddaughter, Lesia, I hope I'm saying that right, and her great niece, Alona, right, who you are helping bring to Israel. You have been in touch with them actually for decades. I wonder what you were thinking when you saw that Russia was invading Ukraine and just how incredibly worried you were for them.
Yeah, we were very worried. We couldn't imagine that the situation would evolve to, you know, to a war. And we talked frequently and we sensed the fear and, you know, tense, and they wanted to come here to be safe. So it wasn't a question for me. It was really obvious for me to bring them here to be safe. Although, you know, they have guilt feelings for leaving the rest of the family back there, but, you know, their family wanted them to be safe. So they are here now, and it's home for them, and we are very happy. And still, our thoughts are with the rest of the family and the Ukrainian people back there in Ukraine.
Yeah, and I know, Sharon, tell us about this, because there are still struggles. I know that they have had problems with visas, right? And that you want Israel to do more to help people like your really adopted family. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, you know, we submitted a request that they could come here a week and a half ago. And the immediate answer was no. And I couldn't accept it because, you know, my grandmother and grandfather were sheltered for as long as they needed back then, when it was really horrific. And you know, if they would have found a Jewish girl in their house, then they would kill everyone. So I started, you know, I involved the media. And from then on, it was, you know, the interest that people found in this story was amazing. So the former head of the Jewish agency, Yad Vashem, and the foreign interior ministry, they got involved, and then, you know, the refusal was canceled. The reason they didn't get, you know, like immediate acceptance was that Israel gives visa to righteous among the nations for 5 years, a 5 year visa to come here and work. And after that, they are deported. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, if I can compare it, you know, my grandmother they didn't, she didn't get a time limit on us stay over there when it was really terrible and, you know, all our family was murdered. And now we should not do that either. Just one last sentence. You know, in Igbo, we have a saying that you should treat your neighbor like yourself. So I think that's what the rest of the world should do now. And, you know, think about others and be kind, because kindness comes back to you.
I just love that story. I just absolutely love that story.
I think we're going to hear about a lot more of these stories as things progress. I think it's, you know, right now things are so chaotic, but I do believe there's a lot of miracles and a lot of really amazing things are happening right now. You know, obviously in the midst of crisis, we're focused on the crisis, but I do believe, look, we're in a season of Purim. It's a season of miracles, and we're going to hear a lot of it. I mean, even that nice story that you sent me, Mike, it was in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency about a rabbi and his wife going to Ukraine to celebrate Purim with the Jews who were in complete limbo and in terror. All these people that are trying to escape from the cities of Ukraine but are still stuck there. I mean, the fact that they would go to Ukraine, go into a war zone to bring, a sense of celebration to the people during Purim, when we remember the salvation of our God, when God saved us from, another evil type of dictator, Haman, who was like the prime minister or the viceroy to the king, who, sought our destruction and God, saved us, saved the Jews from Haman's evil plan. And here we are, like, you've got the rabbis going back in and telling the children, we're going to have a party. We're going to celebrate.
Right.
I love that. I mean, to me, that makes me so joyful when I think about, giving these children, a moment of hope and joy. During this week, as we all celebrated Purim and still praying for some Purim miracles.
And we have two Purim stories. Here's one I did not realize, I think you sent it to me, was that the Jewish community has proof of the purchase of the tomb of Mordecai and Esther, and their tombs are in Iran.
Of course. Well, that's the ancient kingdom of Persia. When the Book of Esther is being read, when the Megillah is being read, that's where it's taking place. It's taking place in Iran and Persia, Shushan. So there's that letter which demonstrates the acquisition of the tomb of Mordechai and Esther by the Jewish community. They're purchasing it from the Shah of Iran at the time, so that it would come into the Jewish community's hands. And there, by the way, there are several other tombs of some of Israel's prophets in ancient Persia, modern day Iran. We've been living there for thousands and thousands of years since the first exile.
The problem is, even though we have that paper, you're probably not going to get the Iranian government to go, yeah, come on in, visit them anytime you want.
I wouldn't want to be a Jew in Iran. But I think, the other cool thing that happens to me, so Turkey, so for those of you in the midst of everything, probably didn't remember this, but obviously Turkey and Israel have had some pretty tense relations over the last 6, 7, 8 years, with the president of Turkey pretty much becoming a dictator himself and wanting to establish his own caliphate. I mean, this is documented. He wanted to establish his own caliphate, and he was competing with Iran against who can get the first caliphate going. And so there is obviously tensions between Turkey and Israel, even though they had historically wonderful relations. So this past week, Israel's President Herzog visited Turkey and met with Erdogan. I can never say his name properly.
Erdogan, yeah. It doesn't look like it sounds.
It's like Erdogan, yeah. But there's a sound to it. You had to have that. There's like an accent to it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I love this. So he agreed to return Israel's most important ancient inscription. So when King Hezekiah had the water tunnel, the Siloam pool and water tunnel in Jerusalem built about 2,700 years ago, there was this inscription about the building of this Siloam water tunnel, this pool that goes up into Jerusalem. And it's been in the possession of Turkey, and they have agreed to restore it based on the visit last week with President Herzog. They've agreed to restore it to Israel. I just, as part of like,
I was not aware of that until you sent me that story at all. So that is good. That's optimistic. One other Purim story. Did you see the thing I sent you about the Gregors that we pull around every time they mention Haman?
Yeah, make a lot of noise. Drown out his name.
Drown out his name. Well, actually, it wasn't a Jewish tradition. It was actually started a long time ago. It was used by the church. It was used by all sorts of things to call people together, to make noise.
Oh, the Groggers, really?
Yeah, yeah. And it predates Purim and all, but we just adopted it to drown out his name. So I thought that was a pretty, right. That's my only Purim story.
Because there's probably people going, what? Okay, so when we say the name Haman, boo. All right, because Haman is from the line of Amalek. And Amalek attacked us, the Israelites, when we were leaving Egypt. He came from behind and attacked the stragglers. And God said that you must remove the name of Amalek from the face of the earth. And so Haman was a descendant of Amalek. So, and Amalek sought to destroy Israel. And so when we say Haman's name, and just like God says, you will remove Amalek's name from the face of the earth. Same with Haman. So if you say his name, you take your grogger, which, you know, you spin around and it makes a lot of noise. It's very noisy. If you don't have one, you're like, boo, so that you can't hear his name, because we're erasing his name from the face of the earth.
Like, something we should do with Putin.
I agree. As
far as I'm concerned.
You know, we should find out Putin's bloodline goes all the way back to Amalek. I'm telling you, we should find out.
Stranger things have happened.
Right.
Amnesty International, we talked about this last week, was blasted by 25 Jewish House members because their executive director, O'Brien, what's his first name? Peter or Paul? I don't know.
Paul O'Brien. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He said that Israel should not exist. And 25 members, the Jewish members of the House, Democratic members of the House.
All of them, which is like the first time they've ever all come together in a letter to show a sign of unity. They were so angry.
Well, it's like the name of our show. It's two Jews, three opinions. I mean, to get 25.
It's a big deal. Right. And you know, all condemned him, right?
Think about it. But that was a good thing. And what are they thinking? You know, I used to think that Amnesty International was a wonderful organization fighting for peace in this world. I will never give another dime to Amnesty International. They're horrible people.
They really are. And you can tell that they have allowed their hatred to sort of drive their agenda. I mean, the fact they're so focused on
what they
Israel,
are doing. Yeah.
And they don't even focus on China. They don't focus on any of these other nations and these horrible things, even Iran that's going on right now, they're not focusing on these horrific human rights violations that are happening every day in this world. It's like they are so centrally focused on Israel, Israel alone. It's really disturbing. I think, Mike, the other thing I don't want to get biased without mentioning it. I think this is really important because this past Thursday was the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And, you know, again, it of course, Iran was behind that bombing. Many people died in that bombing of the Jewish Community Center there. And still to this day, the perpetrators have not been brought to justice. When, you know, and if you recall, there's so much controversy in Argentina for many years.
Because so many of the Germans migrated to Argentina, right, after the Nazis, not Germans. Yeah. I mean, they were the German, Nazis, but they were Nazis. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the SS, because they didn't want to be prosecuted. And what was really interesting is, you know, if you remember the lead prosecutor who was going after the ones who perpetrated this crime, he ended up dead, murdered. And so there's just been all kinds of controversy around this and the ability to sort of help you know, bring to justice the perpetrators of this crime. But obviously still very real 30 years later, and there still hasn't been a single.
And they still haven't found anybody, you know, but people do stand up for the Jews who aren't Jewish. And we're going to introduce you to someone who is one of my favorite interviews that we've had. Loreen did it. It was a great interview with a woman named Olga Washington, who fights for Jews. She is not Jewish. And she is just so dynamic, so wonderful. And we'll tell you about that after we take a break. This is The Third Opinion.
That interview is coming right up. Our website, if you don't know, is thirdopinionpodcast.com. Give it a visit. You can leave us a comment or suggestion, learn more about our hosts, and hear podcasts you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW and on the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
And I'm Loreen Jaffe.
Loreen, this interview, really, as I mentioned before the break, is one of my favorite that we've had. You did a great job. Explain who Olga is. We first met her through a book where she was lauded as a hero. Go ahead, pick it up.
So twofold, right? So first of all, Dumasani Washington, for some of you who may remember, Dumasani's a huge advocate for Israel as well, as he has the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel here in the States. He is Olga's father-in-law. Olga Washington, she is a South African Black woman, born and raised in South Africa, was born in a young girl while apartheid still existed. She is one of the individuals, one of the righteous ones, that is written about in Ari Middleman's book, Path of the Righteous. For those, you know, Ari was on our show, I want to say about 2 months ago, and I still encourage you to check out his book. And she, I mean, what an extraordinary, articulate woman. What she's doing to educate young Jews here in the United States through Club Z, what she and her father, who have seen firsthand the crimes of apartheid, are doing to confront and refute the lies that Israel is apartheid in South Africa and throughout the continent of Africa is really extraordinary. So just enjoyed speaking with her, and here she is.
Absolutely. So Club Z is a Zionist youth organization. We're a nonprofit. Our founder is Marsha Mikhailova, and she approximately 8 years ago discovered that Jewish teens in high school were ill-equipped to understand how to identify anti-Semitism. They found themselves at a place where they couldn't confidently defend their Jewish identity. She then realized that we could not wait for Jewish teens and Zionists to learn about the nuance and the real aspects of Israel and the conflict when they got to college. As we know, college, unfortunately, has become a hotbed of anti-Semitism, that there needed to be work done prior to them getting to college, and so that's what we do. So providing them with deep, deep knowledge and understanding, and then the part that I'm also very passionate about is giving them advocacy skills. Now that you know the information, now that you have this great understanding of what's going on, how do you effectively speak? How do you engage in debate? How do you write? How do you respond to a teacher, to a lecturer when they're saying something that you know is not only historically incorrect, but is borderline anti-Semitic? What do you do? And so those are just some of the aspects and the work of Club Z, and I'm very grateful to be part of this incredible organization.
I mean, that is an amazing organization. I have to say, I can't believe I haven't heard of it before. When I think about, you know, we do deal with almost every college campus right now is a hotbed of anti-Semitism, from the faculty to student organizations, you know, and student government. I mean, college students are confronted with it constantly. I mean, I remember back in the day when I was in college, which was a long, long time ago, it was there. Right. And it's only gotten substantially worse. And I think, you know, having those advocacy skills and having the ability to respond to, you know, these lies of apartheid or these lies of colonization or ethnic cleansing are really important. And tell the audience, like, if a parent wants to get their kids in this club, how do they do it? Is it Is it national? Is it based on local high schools? How would they find you? How would they enroll their students?
Well, we are present across the country, and the way in which we work is that we are very reliant on the community. We're a community-based organization. Parents form an integral part of our existence. Our audience are Jewish teens in the 8th through the 12th grade. We currently have chapters in Los Angeles, the Bay Area, which also serves as our headquarters. We also have chapters in New York, specifically Manhattan, Brooklyn, as well as Westchester, and then Charlotte, North Carolina, which is where I'm more directly involved, and also in Boston. So the way in which we work is anybody can look us up. Our website is www.clubz.org. And if there's an express interest to say, we want you in the community, we want this education, and I'll speak a little bit as to how our program works, then we'll come in, and oftentimes we do a pilot program so that the community can get a sense of what we have to offer. We are yet to do a pilot in the community, not say that we want you. And then after that, we do a full-on program. Our program over a course of 1 year looks as follows. We have educational sessions twice a month. And at those educational sessions, which oftentimes last between 2 hours to 2.5 hours, that's where we break down the education. So we have topics ranging from UNRWA, which is the United Nations, right? Now I've gone blank. But the organization in the United Nations that's focused on taking care of the Palestinian people. We look at what's the difference between that group as well as other entities of the United Nations that look after refugees, and why is there a difference? We look at aspects of apartheid. What does that mean? We look at what is indigeneity? Who are indigenous people? Why can Israel and why can Jews more specifically say that they are indigenous to the land of Judea and Samaria? We look at the different wars that Israel has been a part of, and not just, oh, this is a war that happened between this party and that party. We look at what was the impetus for that war? What happened in relation to that war and the borders that ensued from there? And why is it important to have an understanding of what the borders look like? We look at life prior to 1948. The fact that many people don't recognize is that BDS, when they talk about it now, they're like, oh, no, it's not against the Jews. It's only against the Zionist state of Israel. And we're like, okay, if that's what they're saying about BDS now, why did boycotts and sanctions happen prior to 1948 when there was no Jewish state? So helping teens see issues like that. And there's a whole detailed curriculum that we go through. We are, however, also, Laureen, very involved in creating a network for our teens so that teens mm-hmm. don't feel alone. When they're on campus, they know that there are friends that they can call on. They know that there are educators that they can call on. And so we have social events that also take place throughout the year where the teens come together, they connect. There's always a little bit of education there because we feel that you can't do too much education. And so that's what we look like. We also have an incredible, incredible conference that happens once a year. And in this year, we had it in Miami, Florida. And here we bring all of our students from across the country. They come together. So imagine over 100 young people. That's the number that we had this year. They're coming together and they're like, wow, we're part of this incredible Zionist organization that is proud to not water down why they stand with Israel, but who are very courageous and very bold to say that we are unapologetically Zionist, and these are the reasons why we are and why we're prepared to speak up. In addition to that, we also do community outreach events because Club Z has recognized that if we're going to address anti-Semitism, there's also a responsibility on the teens as well as on the Jewish community to speak to allies and to create allies outside of the community. And how do you do that? How do you go about doing that? So on a whole, that's what our program looks like. We encourage our teens to be with us for at least 2 years. As you can appreciate, the complexities as well as information relating to Israel and the Jewish people is thousands of years old. And so you can't compress that if you want to have somebody who has a deep understanding of their heritage and what's going on there. So we are in it for the long haul, a minimum of 2 years. And obviously, if people can't be with us for 2 years, that's fine. But our program is designed for at least 2 years because we want to give parents in particular the confidence to know that once they've been through a Club Z program, their teen will go on campus and will come through even though they may meet anti-Semitism, but they will come through not turning their back on their Jewish identity, not turning their back on Israel, which unfortunately is something that has happened. Jewish students will be Zionists. They'll get on college campus and then they'll be like, oh, you never told me that this is what Israel is doing to the Palestinian children. You never told me this is what, that this is what Israel is about. And they turn their backs on Israel and they become anti-Zionists. So a minimum of 2 years for us that parents have this confidence to say, you know what, this next generation of Jewish teens isn't just going to be Jewish in name only, but they're going to be Jewish in action, and they are still going to be very have a very strong allegiance to the land of Israel and to the state of Israel.
It's amazing. Well, knowledge is power. So, you know, the fact that you're equipping these children, these students with knowledge and in informing them on the actual facts to be able to respond to the lies. I mean, there are just, you know, no matter which way you turn, you know, you are confronted with blood libel lies. And so to be able to respond to it articulately with advocacy and with real facts is tremendous. And so, you know, which again, everyone, we've been talking about Club Z. And which leads me to sort of the next question, because I'm just amazed listening to you, Olga, right? I mean, you're not Jewish. You are a woman from South Africa. What is your driver? What created this passion in you for Israel?
So you are right. I'm a South African woman who now finds her home in the United States. I'm actually a Christian as well. And Laureen, the person that introduced me to actually speaking up on the topic of Israel and being an advocate was my father. So several years ago, I was brought up in a Christian home. But Israel was this country, not my problem. Olga was a successful lawyer. She was doing her thing. I was ignorant as to the fact that at this present moment in time, the war isn't necessarily geopolitical, but it's very much ideological. And so there's this war of lies that's going on. My father came back several years ago after having been on a tour of the United States and Canada, and he came across BDS work on campus, and he was very on fire, very hot, and he was like, there is this lie going on university campuses that Israel is an apartheid state, like, and the Palestinian people are suffering like Black South Africans suffered, and because this is a lie, South Africans have got a moral obligation to speak up and tell the world that this is a lie, because we experience it, but more specifically Black South Africans. And I was like, Dad, I kind of get it, but you're busy, I'm busy, this is not our problem, other people can do it. And as a wise man did, he ignored me, and he founded a nonprofit organization, which I now also serve as the CEO of. I wear multiple hats. And I'll speak a little bit to that later. But as Laureen, I started to learn of what was going on, because I was then brought on as Daisy's legal advisor, and then I moved up in terms of being more and more at the forefront. I recognized that, wait a minute, there was this lie that was going on, but also here was this group of people who, just because of who they were, the world was hating on them. Many people in the world wanted to see their destruction. And as a Christian, I couldn't just sit down as somebody who believes in truth and justice and in righteousness and not do anything about it. So I then also, as I started to learn more, recognized, and this is the first pillar for why I do what I do, that as a Christian, there would not be any Christianity without Judaism. We talk about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but hang on, he's the God of the Jews. We talk about Moses and these incredible stories of the Exodus, but those aren't Christian stories. We speak of King David and all these things. And then I realized, I was like, wait a minute, even this Old Testament that we read of, the books of Moses, that's Torah. And so I was then grateful and appreciative as to, okay, I need to have an understanding and an appreciation for the Jewish people in order for me to have my faith. And I'm very passionate and grateful for my faith. So that's the first reason. The second reason was, as a South African, and I've pretty much alluded to it, that there's a moral obligation on South Africans to stand up and say, no, this is not apartheid, because if what is happening in Israel now was apartheid, there would have been no need for the Nelson Mandela in the way that the world has come to know and appreciate him. There would have been no need for the liberation movement in South Africa. It is trivializing the real tragedy and the evil of how our grandparents, parents, even me to a little bit, because I was born during apartheid South Africa, of what we suffered. it's just, it's untruthful. Like, we can say, and we have examples, we can show the scars of what apartheid was and what apartheid is not, so people cannot take our narrative and manipulate it in order to see the destruction of the democratic state of Israel. And then the third reason is, as an African, I'm a proud African, Maureen. I look at my continent with all of her challenges, the war, the poverty, but I know that she has got a lot more to offer. She is rich beyond in her resources and her minerals, her people and the capacity that she has. But we need help and we need a friend. And when there's countries that are extending a friendship to the African continent because they realize Africa's potential, such as Iran and China, and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm sure we can do better here. And so even as a student of history, as a student of history, I've come to realize that in the 1950s and the 1960s, in fact, even before the 1950s, 1960s, when you look at the first diplomatic relationship between Israel and any nation on the world or any region in the world, it was with Queen Sheba and Solomon. So Africa started this diplomatic relationship with Israel. So we've got this extended relationship from thousands of years ago. But then you come into the modern era, you look at the 1950s and the 1960s, and you read about how on the African continent, as these countries were coming out of colonization and were needing to figure out how they could become self-dependent and create infrastructure and health systems and agriculture and all of these things, there was a friend, there was a nation on the African continent that became a very good friend, a nation who, after the United States, has the most number of embassies, and that was the nation of Israel. So despite she being brand new in terms of her rebirth, she was on the African continent with her people, teaching African people security, teaching them things about agriculture, medicine, and various things. And I'm like, wait a minute. So Israel was our friend. She continues and can still be our friend. And so there's a responsibility on people like myself to speak up and say the roads on which we walk on, the education that our forefathers received, Israel had a role. We were better. We were empowered by this friend. And as we now have another need, to become more empowered. She can be a friend and she must be our friend. She wants to be our friend. And so we cannot allow a falsehood, a narrative of wanting to boycott and divest and turn our back against a people and a country who have proven themselves to be good to us, even though we've had our ups and downs. But show me any relationship where there's no ups and downs. We must be friends with Israel. And so that those are the three reasons that inform why I do what I do. My faith, my country, South Africa, and my continent, Africa.
And she, I mean, what an extraordinary, articulate woman. What she's doing to educate young Jews here in the United States through Club Z, what she and her father, who have seen firsthand the crimes of apartheid, are doing to confront and refute the lies that Israel is an apartheid in South Africa and throughout the continent, Africa, is really extraordinary. So just enjoyed speaking with her.
And she had so much to say. We've got part two next week. I hope you were as impressed with her as I was. She's just
100%, 100%. Just wow. Powerful.
Yeah. So we will get to part two next week. A big controversy this week with AIPAC. I don't know if we've talked about it on the air, but I think they made a huge mistake, and they've always been theoretically nonpartisan, but
bipartisan
better, but they put together a political action committee. I hate political action committees, regardless of whether I agree with them or not. I think it's downgrades our political system. Money in the system is the downfall, I think, of a lot of our politics. But they have formed a PAC. When people call for solicitation, first thing I ask is, are you a PAC? And I say, yep. I go, nope, don't contribute to PACs. But now they're involved in a controversy in two ways, endorsing some Democrats who are in favor of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal.
In 2015, specifically those who voted in favor.
Voted for it. But a lot of them want to vote for it again and want to put it back together. But still, they're doing that. And then they also have endorsed a bunch of Republicans and giving them money, including Republicans who voted not to certify the election. And I have a huge problem with this. This was after the January 6th riots. I think that anybody who voted not to certify it, that didn't believe that that was a honest election, really sullies Congress's name.
Well, I think they're two different things, and I don't think AIPAC is involved in that type of politics. So I don't think it's controversial.
But they're endorsing 57 Republicans.
Well, I don't think there's a problem with it, Mike. I mean, you know, first of all, the vote also took place before, you know, the quote unquote riot took place. So I don't. That has nothing to do with it. I mean, this is so.
No,
first
it
of all,
does,
I,
though. It, no, no, no. If you're giving money to people, the people that in many ways supported the insurrection, I have a problem with that.
Technically, so I don't want to get off on this because I wanted to talk about AIPAC. It's really important. So technically, the FBI has said, as a matter of law, it's not an insurrection. So whatever you want to call it.
Wait. When did the FBI say that? I don't recall seeing that anywhere.
The FBI, when they testified, yes, they testified before Congress, and they specifically said that. So, but beyond that, the vote was happening. There was a vote happening in Congress, and there were real concerns that some people were making that I think were legitimate. And I'm not, that had nothing to do with Trump or the rally or whatever else was going on. Because if you recall, members of Congress sitting in Congress weren't outside part of whatever was going on. Most of them didn't even know what was going on outside.
Wait. 61 courts with a lot of Trump judges said there was no basis for questioning the legitimacy of the election.
Mike, I don't want to get into this again. This is like...
If AIPAC is giving money to Congressmen that supported it, I do want to get into it. That's
First of all, 61 courts, the predominant number of those courts were procedural, not actual evidentiary issues. So I don't want to get into the fact of that. What AIPAC is doing, what it's always done, there is lay leadership, like people like me who support candidates who support the U.S.-Israel relationship. We're not looking at other issues. The predominant issue that AIPAC is concerned about is the U.S.-Israel relationship. And that's what's important, because we know that there's enough members of Congress today, and the number is growing, that are anti-Israel. And we make that. And so there's nothing new or different. You might not like the idea of PACs, but the fact of the matter is that J Street and all these other organizations were doing PACs and claiming they were the voice of the Jewish world, which wasn't.
I think that J Street is wrong with doing a PAC as well. I go across the board. I think it was a huge mistake by AIPAC and hurts their credibility.
I don't think so. I don't think it's a huge mistake.
It does with me. It certainly does with me.
What? AIPAC has always been bipartisan because we don't.
But
think
when you're doing a PAC, you're no longer bipartisan. You become political. But
no, it's not. AIPAC's not non-political. Let's be really clear about this. Politics is politics. But AIPAC has always been bipartisan. And whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, if you are a supporter of the U.S.-Israel relationship, then the lay leadership of AIPAC, people who aren't paid lobbyists, but people who support the U.S.-Israel relationship, are likely going to support you, and they're going to want to donate money to you, and they're going to do that. And
that's fine. We ought to do, Lorene, we're really out of time. We're running way over. Okay. Let's see if we can get somebody on from AIPAC to talk about it. It's a legitimate issue. Let's talk about that. I think once we get past all the Ukraine stuff,
fair enough.
Okay. Hey, listen, thank you for listening to us. I hope you enjoyed the show. Tell your friends about it. We're available wherever your podcasts are available. This is The Third Opinion. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe, and like us on Facebook.
That's our podcast this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.